I have really been involved in two major areas of research. The first area of research is public history, and that includes things like archives, museums, historic homes, but it also includes things like podcasts, websites, documentary films. And so I teach this at VSU. I teach public history, but before coming here, I was a museum curator. And so in that role, I did a lot of public history research. I worked in a historic house museum in Southern California. It's called Rancho Los Cerritos, and it's located in Long Beach. And while there, I did all kinds of research related to the history of the home, related to the history of the region. And so that was one major area of research for me. The other area of research that I focus on is African American history, civil rights movement, and popular culture. So right now I'm focusing on a project about a comedian named Jackie Moms Mabley and her work during the civil rights movement. Absolutely. So I am interested in the relationship between popular culture and protest. And Moms Mabley is an artist activist. So, as a comedian during the civil rights movement, during the women's liberation movements of the 60s and 70s, she's using the stage and she's using a public platform to criticize racism, to criticize sexism and Jim Crow, and to challenge, policies of segregation. She was raising the public's consciousness, especially when she achieved national mainstream success among integrated audiences in the 1960s when she started releasing comedy albums that people would listen to in their homes, and when she would perform on television shows like The Merv Griffin Show and Smothers Brothers and other popular late night talk shows. And so with Moms Mabley, I'm interested in how she does things like role reversal, where she will portray herself in fictional scenarios, talking to presidents, criticizing them about foreign policy or about, how they're handling racial issues. And she would always do it in a really humorous way. So, she wouldn't turn audiences away, but while making these jokes that seemed playful, she was really speaking in kind of a double voice, getting people to really think about the issues at hand by using humor. She was absolutely one of the first. She was one of the first female stand-up comedians and, one of the first Black female stand-up comedians, especially to do this work on television. And so what she did really opened the door for women who came after her, most notably Whoopi Goldberg, who portrayed her in a one-woman show in the early 1980s before Whoopi Goldberg herself was really well known. And then more recently in 2013, she produced a documentary about Moms Mabley. So the lineage between those two performers is very clear. Also, recently, Wanda Sykes portrayed Moms Mabley in the show The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And that's another clear lineage between Moms Mabley and Wanda Sykes. And there's a number of other comedians who really acknowledge the influence that she had on them. Well, I spoiled a detail from the third season, but I think you'll still enjoy it. My favorite project in my research on comedy, that would have to be my dissertation on Moms Mabley. So that was really the result of many years of work because I wrote my master's thesis about Moms Mabley and her work during the civil rights movement. But with my dissertation, I expanded the lens of understanding her work and really focused on all the performance work she had done from the 19-teens through the 1970s. She had a really long career. And through my dissertation, I was also able to explore her work during the TOBA, also known as the Chitlin Circuit, the Harlem Renaissance, some films that she did in the 30s and 40s, as well as look at the work that she did around civil rights and women's liberation in the 60s and 70s. And so, you know, that was a favorite project just because I got to spend so much time with this research. And I'm still working on that research because I'm turning that dissertation. I'm revising it and turning it into a book that I hope to publish soon. I love my research, and I've been working on Moms Mabley for years. Again, she was the topic of my master's thesis. Before that, she was one of my first, you know, research projects in my master's program. And so I've really been studying Moms Mabley. At this point, it's been over 10 years, and I just enjoy it so much. I think it helps that I get to listen to comedy albums, you know, as part of my primary source research. But it's a lot more than that. It's that I've found a topic that I really care about and I'm passionate about. And I feel that there's more and more to learn and deeper ways to interpret the source material. She does not have a museum dedicated to her. She was originally from Brevard, North Carolina, but she left as a young woman. Brevard is a very small mountain town in western North Carolina. The closest city to there is Asheville. So I have not visited Asheville or Brevard yet, but I did visit Harlem, which is really where she made her home for most of her life. So she left Brevard at a young age to be a performer, and she traveled a lot in the early years of her career, but she established herself during the Harlem Renaissance in Harlem and, you know, then moved to a suburb outside of Harlem. But really, New York City is where she established herself and where she really considered home. And so a few years ago, I went to go conduct research about Moms Mabley at the Schomburg Center, which is really the place to be for African-American cultural history research. It's a branch of the New York Public Library, and it's all focused on African-American history, African-American culture. And so while I was there, I ran into a woman who does tours in Harlem, and she knew a great deal about Moms Mabley. She knew a great deal about the Harlem Renaissance. And so she gave me a personal walking tour through Harlem to see the different places where Moms Mabley would have performed. So I've not yet visited any of her homes. Those are not publicly acknowledged sites yet, but hopefully one day. It really was. Yeah, I got very lucky. You know, you just never know who you'll run into when you're out doing research. Absolutely. So one of the major obstacles that I confronted early on in my Moms Mabley research was the fact that her comedy recordings had not been digitized at all. They were not available online for the most part. There were some YouTube clips of her performing on television, but in order for me to do proper research, I needed access to the 21 comedy albums that she had released of her various performances in the 60s and 70s. And so in order to access this primary source material, I needed to purchase the original albums on eBay. This was back in 2011 where, you know, these things just weren't digitized online. And even at this point, her full discography is still not completely available online. She has a few tracks on Spotify, but at this point I really needed to create a digital archive of her recordings. And so I purchased her records on eBay, and then I had to turn the recordings into usable MP3s so that I could then transcribe them. And so right around this time, the program that I was working on my master's, California State University San Marcos in North County, San Diego, California, they were developing a digital history program. And so as part of this digital history program, they were establishing a new digital history lab. And so because of my research, it really encouraged them to acquire the type of record player where you can also record MP3 digital files. And so I went through and made recordings of each of the albums that I had purchased. So I then had digital files of all of her performances that had been captured in recordings in these comedy albums. And then I went through and listened to each of them and transcribed them by hand. There's great programs out now to do this. And, you know, there were probably some programs around then, but I was a master's student on a shoestring budget who had just purchased all those eBay albums. So I did the transcribing by hand myself. And I encourage those listening to go and check out a couple of YouTube clips of Moms Mabley performing. First of all, because it's fantastic and it'll provide great examples of the things I'm talking about. But also you'll be able to see her performance style. As part of her persona, she takes out her dentures and she speaks in non-vernacular or non-standard vernacular English. And so these aspects made it very difficult for me to accurately transcribe her material. So I would have to listen and repeat. And so that was incredibly challenging. And then also she was speaking to an audience who was grounded in the context of the time. So she would make references to current events that were going on in the 1960s. Now, as a master's student in history, I knew a lot of what she was talking about because I was studying that history, but there were certainly times where I wasn't sure what she was talking about, and I would then go and have to do research to even understand what she was saying to fully comprehend the jokes and the commentary that she was providing. So that was a major obstacle, was actually creating a usable body of primary source materials. And that was how I overcame it. I was able to get all of her recordings on eBay. It did take some time. You know, I feel like I lucked out that there weren't a lot of auctions, you know, like I wasn't competing with a lot of buyers. Some items were more expensive than others. Some were in better condition than others. You know, some of their albums had scratches because they were originals. But, you know, it took some time and it took a lot of, you know, investment on my part. And now I have a wonderful record album collection of Moms Mabley albums. But yeah, that was certainly a major time and financial investment for me. There was no place where it was a complete run. And again, that may have changed since then, but you know, there would be places where maybe they had it, but you could only access it in the library. And as far as funding goes, it was cheaper for me to buy it on eBay than to fly out to a library somewhere else in the country to access the recordings. Now, once I got to go to the Schomburg, and once I got to go to the library at the Kennedy Center, also in New York City, I was able to access more materials in addition to these comedy albums. But, you know, that's an obstacle that we run into with research, right? Where sometimes we have to make decisions about where we can best use our resources to access the materials we need. And sometimes we need to make workarounds, especially when you're a master's student and you don't have access to as much funding. I would love to find a way to combine public history and, you know, Moms Mabley's story and her history. And I would love to make her materials more accessible to the public. And so, you know, if the best way to do that is through a house museum, that would be amazing. If it's creating, you know, a website with a repository of her recordings, that would be wonderful. So I'm not sure exactly what it would look like, but I would be very interested in finding a way to make her material really accessible and available to the public through public history methodologies. Right. There's definitely some of that, but you know, for my research, a lot of it is using perhaps unexpected or untraditional, less traditional sources. So, you know, the record albums that I just spoke about, watching YouTube videos. You know, recently I was writing a piece of a chapter about Moms Mabley, and she was a presenter at the Grammy Awards in 1974. And so I did a deep dive. I didn't go to the library. I went to the archives of the Grammys online, and I was watching, you know, YouTube recordings of her presenting an award at the Grammys. And so it's a lot of audiovisual sources, watching old episodes of late night TV talk shows. She was on a television special called A Time for Laughter. So, you know, watching television recordings, that's a lot of my primary source material. I also really focus on newspaper and magazine interviews and coverage of Moms Mabley. But of course, I spent a great deal of time in the census as well when I'm trying to figure out where she lived and, you know, where her family lived. So it's certainly a combination of traditional sources and audiovisual type of sources. That's right. And that's a big issue in digital history. That's a big focus in digital history, is preserving audio recordings and preserving them in formats that will last. And so that is some of the work that archivists do, depending on the type of collections they have. That's a major concern, is maintaining recordings and also shifting them into new formats without losing their integrity. That's such a great question. I have gone about this a few different ways. So while I was finishing my dissertation, I was also a full-time museum curator. And so I could not find those long stretches to write very easily. And so I learned how to chip away. And a lot of times I would wake up really early in the morning before work and spend, you know, an hour of writing in the morning. There is this method that is attributed to the comedian Jerry Seinfeld. And, you know, I find it very fitting that I adopted the method of another famous comedian. But when he was building up his career, he would need to write jokes, right? That's how comedians build their career, build their material. And so he needed to write jokes, and he decided that he should be writing jokes every day. And so he would put a calendar up on his wall, and he would put an X over each day that he wrote. And so he got to a point where he did not want to break the chain. He wanted a chain of X's to write every day. And that really inspired me as I was dealing with writer's block and dealing with just limited time working full time while also trying to complete my dissertation. And so I tried the Jerry Seinfeld method. And the deal I made with myself was, even if you just write 15, 30 minutes, if you touch the dissertation, then you get to put an X on the calendar. And what I found is that when I sat down to write, I didn't want to stop after 15 or 30 minutes, right? I think the hardest part is sitting down and getting started. And so for me, it's really about consistency. But of course, 15 minutes every day is not going to get you very far. So I do want to make sure that I have those bigger chunks. And now that I'm a professor, I'm very fortunate in that I have more time to write, because that's officially part of my job now. And so the way that I do it is I divide up my work days. So on certain days of the week, those have been allocated as research and writing days, where I have longer research and writing blocks. And then on other days where I have more classes, those I assign to more of my teaching responsibilities. Another thing that I do that's really helpful, because we're not just writing, we're teaching and doing service and engaging with students, is sometimes you think you'll be able to get right back to whatever it is you are working on, but other things come up, especially if we're writing more than one thing at a time. So what I'll do is leave breadcrumbs for myself, and I will have like a work journal document for each item, each article or chapter or dissertation that I'm working on, to leave a note for myself of the last thing I was doing. Yes, it's very helpful. Absolutely. Another thing that I find helpful in dealing with distractions is I will set a timer. Because sometimes it's hard to get started, or sometimes you only do have, 30 minutes to work on something, but setting a timer and telling myself the only thing I'm going to work on is this piece of writing or this piece of research, helps me to not look at my phone, check my email, whatever other distractions come my way. Setting a timer really helps me focus on one task at a time because multitasking does not work if you're trying to get research, writing, any focused work done. I like that. I'm going to adopt that myself. Hey, you found something that works. That's great. My favorite part is these aha moments where you have a question, you have a research question. Maybe it's not your initial research question. Maybe you're several steps into the research, you've made some good progress, and you get to a point where you are curious about something or you feel that something needs to be answered to get to the next step of your research. Finding an unexpected or finding a really compelling source to help answer that question is so exciting to me every time it happens, whether it's a newspaper source or an interview or something like that. Finding that little nugget that answers that question once you're immersed in the research is my favorite part. It's such an exciting feeling every time it happens. And my least favorite part of the research is starting. It's that blank page. It's what can sometimes be an overwhelming feeling of saying, okay, I have a research question. I've read the literature on what other people have said about this topic. I have some ideas, of how to answer this research question. I have some ideas of where sources might be, but I don't know where to go next. I haven't written anything yet. It's starting. I find that really challenging. I do. I definitely work best in an outline because, again, it takes away that scary blank page and it also helps remind you of where you're going. It makes a big project feel much more manageable, helps you stay organized. So, I really do like to work with an outline. It's how I was taught to write, as a young student, and it's worked for me ever since. So, I'm a big fan of the outline. Right. I have a few different pieces of advice about research. One of them is to consider what your sources can be, right? To look beyond the very traditional expected source material of, your secondary sources are, peer-reviewed journal articles and academic books, and your primary sources are, speeches and diaries and you know, if newspaper articles and these official feeling documents, those are all legitimate and very much a part, important part of research. But think about untraditional expected sources. Think about sources that are not written, right? We don't want to overlook the sources of visual media, audio media, 3D objects, artifacts are absolutely sources that are worthy of research. And, you know, in the front of my mind is history because I'm a historian, but I think that this advice applies to many other disciplines. When you're doing research, think beyond the very traditional type of materials, because that's going to expand the type of research you're able to do. That's going to make it really interesting and exciting for you. That's also going to make it more inclusive and accessible. If we are only looking at, you know, the official documents with a capital D, then only certain stories and only certain experiences are being captured. But if we are looking at photographs, if we are looking at physical objects, handmade objects, objects that are respected by cultures other than our own, then you're capturing a lot more information about the human experience, and you're including a lot more people and communities in the stories that you're telling with your research. And so that's really important work for us to be doing as academics and as scholars, both professors and students, as we need to be thinking about who we are including and whose voices we are honoring in the research that we do. The other advice that I would give is to perhaps think long-term. And this depends on where you are in your research and your academic career. If you're doing a research project and, you know, you're in a class where you're very limited in the type of work you're going to do, and you know that this is not something you want to pursue, that's one thing. But if you are doing research for a class that you're interested in, and you think you might want to continue with this, then imagine yourself doing this research years down the road. That's not to add pressure, but that's just to get you thinking about, you know, what you might want to do with your research in the future. One thing I wish I had done more as an undergraduate and a graduate student was publish my work, was churn my research projects into articles. You know, once I figured out that a research paper I write for one class I could put into my master's thesis, that really helped things along. But try to find ways to make the work that you do in your classes count for more than just that class. That could also mean presenting it at a conference, such as the Undergraduate Research Symposium we have here on campus. The Georgia Undergraduate Research Conference is another example. So think about how you can take the work that you're doing and make it so that your professor is not the only one who reads it. Make it so that you can share your work with other students and other scholars, whether that's through conferences, publishing it in a journal, or using it as furthering your research if you want to do graduate work. Yes. Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Laverne, for having me. It was a pleasure.